You're listening to K-Chung Radio with Divided Daughters.
And special guest, Rachel Mason.
Hi, everyone. This is Rachel Mason.
Hi, Rachel. Welcome. Okay. Chung. Welcome to K-Chung.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're setting up right now.
We like feedback.
We're working on our feedback issues. Can you plug this in?
This is live.
Live in Chinatown.
We just hit the ground. Ah, sure. This is cool. We just hit the ground running, and I'm just uploading my computer. So just straight up go for it.
K-Chung Radio. K-Chung Radio.
Is that going to be long enough? Because I've got a longer one.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to sing a song from my film, The Lives of Hamilton Fish, and I'm very excited to be here in L.A., because I am from L.A., but I'm just going to make sure. I can't hear myself through these yet.
Check. And
check, one, two, three. Should we have that other microphone on the guitar, or? Can you hear? I can't hear anything through, but.
The only way to do the monitors is to turn up the
music. Oh, okay. I'm hearing some music.
K-Chung Radio. 16:30 a.m.
Cool. Okay.
So Rachel Mason.
Yes, thank you.
Divided Daughters.
I'll play a kind of short song from my film, The Lives of Hamilton Fish, and this song is called Grace, and I can give an explanation afterwards about what the song is about.
Grace, the Lord asked me to save her. Grace, she is my lover. Grace, the Lord asked me to take her to the other side. Grace, my little angel. Grace, she is my angel. Grace, the Lord asked me to take her home tonight. And when he calls me, I cannot resist. I am a servant. Servant of the Lord. I held her by the hand, and then I held her by the wrist. Well, she tried to run, she made a tiny fist, and how she turned from an angel to a witch. I buried my angel in a ditch.
That song was called Grace. Oops. That song is called Grace, and it's about the little girl in my film that was actually a real person in real life named Grace Budd who was murdered by a serial killer of children named Hamilton, a.k.a. Albert Fish.
Well, tell us what your film is about.
So the film is about two men named Hamilton Fish, and the one that I just mentioned was a serial killer who changed his name from Hamilton to Albert, not legally. So when he died, he was buried. Actually, he was executed at Sing Sing Prison, and I discovered him because I was looking up people who were executed at Sing Sing, and he was on this list as the oldest person ever executed. And when I looked up the date of his execution, I discovered that there was another man with the same exact name, Hamilton Fish, and they both were pronounced dead on the same front page of the Peekskill Evening Star News. So I just started getting ideas about this strange coincidence and writing songs, because that's what I do, I write songs. And I, over the course of 7 years having this as a kind of project on the back burner, I eventually put it all together into a film. I also did an art exhibition with some of the ephemera at a space called Marginal Utility Gallery in Philadelphia. And so I made this film. And the two men named Hamilton Fish are both notorious in their own right. And interestingly, last week I just met with an enthusiast and also a well-known artist who's an enthusiast of ephemera related to a lot of different killers. And his name is Joe Coleman. And one sort of related artifact is when Albert Hamilton Fish killed and dismembered a little girl, he wrote a letter to the girl's mother, and it's to date one of the most incredible pieces of serial killer artifacts. And I got to see it with my own eyes last week. It was really troubling and unbelievable.
What did the letter say?
So the letter is something that actually anyone can look up online. It's been transcribed. And it basically talks about his obsession with cannibalism and why he ate the little girl, saying that it was a common practice among people in China, and really he kind of goes into this.
Was he Chinese?
No, he's not at all. And in fact, I don't even know if he ever went to China. He was a very deranged person, and he cannibalized children. So he wrote a letter to the child's mother, describing,
or justifying what he was doing.
Exactly.
Because he couldn't fathom, like, her dismay or something. Or, like, he just wanted to explain to her, like, his reasoning and how it made total sense.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's hard to know why he did that. And in talking to Joe Coleman last week, he was a very devout Catholic. And Joe was also raised Catholic. And one of the strange things in the letter was that he constantly brings up the fact that he did not defile her, like he didn't rape her. Like, it was okay that he murdered and dismembered her.
And ate her,
but didn't rape her, And that she died a virgin. He made a point of that. And so one of the, one of the things that Joe had mentioned was that is a very profound piece of his psyche, just being Catholic. So I don't know that anyone will ever know why he did that, but, he is a human who existed on planet Earth and did inconceivable things.
What period of time was this?
So he was executed at Sing Sing in the electric chair in 1936, and he committed this crime in 1928. So the period of his investigation, the time frame from 1928 to 1936 was when there was this all-out manhunt to find him, and it was in New York.
Had he murdered multiple children?
So the number of children that he murdered is to date unknown, but because things were, a little different in the forensics back then, it's not really clear that he definitely killed an exact number, but he definitely killed more than one. And there is some very good probable evidence that he killed at least like 10 to 15, maybe more. But if anyone Googles Albert Fish, they will find a treasure trove of information, because he is a very notorious and, I guess you could say, a beloved by serial killer aficionados. He's like up there.
Was he a celebrity during his time?
No, not at all, actually. I think he became notorious after his discovery and execution.
And who was the other name that you had
mentioned? So the other Hamilton Fish, interestingly, is actually the one who was more famous in his lifetime, because the name Hamilton Fish in the East Coast is and was a very powerful name. You know, there's a handful of families that you probably have heard of, like the Rockefellers and the Roosevelts, and, you know, Hamilton Fish was of that exact New England, almost aristocracy, you could say. And Hamilton Fish was actually a descendant of a governor of New York State. So the Hamilton Fish that died on the one day apart, actually, from the killer Hamilton Fish, who's known as Albert Fish, is and was a member of this very, very, very important family. And in fact, I met Hamilton Fish the Fifth. There is a Hamilton Fish who is alive and well, and he also has some political power, and he was the editor-in-chief of The Nation magazine when I met
him.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And what about this story or these two coincidences made you want to make a film about it? Did you see anything sort of like corresponding in terms of like what's happening in culture today? Because I know you're really interested in kind of topical sort of subject matter for your work. And so I was wondering what kind of spurred you to make a film about this story?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, in a funny way, I would say that in my art and in just my own personality, I've always been obsessed with history and also interesting people. And these people were, I would say, almost anomalies of their day. And I just was fascinated with this story and with my own attempt to reconcile a coincidence that I could see absolutely no other reason for except pure just coincidence. So I would say that if I were to think about things like other work that I've done that relates to political figures or things that I do that's very timely, the closest tie-in I would say is that, you know, there is the question about morality and capital punishment and class in this. You know, one person was basically from a lower class, and the other person was from a really doesn't get higher to be a higher class. And, you know, they both had this perfectly accidental meeting, and also it was set in a time in our country during the Great Depression, which I think is sort of similar. I wouldn't say that this is a depression right now, but we faced, at least when I was working on this in the thick of it, it was definitely in the Great Recession period.
I'd like to say how we kind of all know each other. It's kind of an interesting story, and like why we've asked you to come here.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's a really cool story. You want to go for it?
Oh, yeah. We all went to elementary school together.
We did.
But we didn't necessarily know each other in school very well.
We didn't hang out.
We didn't overlap our classes.
In the same circles.
Yeah. And I think I'm 1 year older than you, or maybe 2 years older. And in that time, like, if you're not in fourth grade together, it's like a huge divide. Because I think I remember you guys might have been in like third or fourth grade. And I think I was in fifth grade. And I remember meeting...
Well, Julie's older than
me. Oh, okay. So maybe our classes didn't overlap, but we didn't actually have... But we went to Wonderland Avenue Elementary School in Los Angeles, in Laurel Canyon. And it just so happened that we met on the schoolyard, I think maybe a couple times, something like that. That's at least what I remember encountering
after
you guys.
After school, I think.
Yeah.
But we actually met for real... when we were all in college, exactly. Which was like the funny kind of coincidence.
I remember specifically when artist friends, I went to UCLA for art and I was friends with some great artists that, you know, Felisa Funes and Trevor Watson, and they were my classmates. And one day they were mentioning the Moon Sisters. I heard them talking about you, and I thought, wow, that sounds really familiar. And then they said Julian Swan, and I thought, you know what? Those must be the girls that I remember from Wonderland Avenue Elementary School. And I said to them, I was like, I wonder if they went to school with me. I don't know. But then we ended up meeting years later, because even at that time, my path didn't exactly overlap with you guys. I guess for some reason, I knew that they knew you, but then I didn't for some reason see you guys.
Well, I think
much.
It was weird because I think the same thing sort of happened where they mentioned you as well. And you had this one kind of infamous piece that you did at UCLA.
Which one?
Where you climbed the wall which building? Mm-hmm. The art building?
Tell us about that.
Well, I scaled it was called the Dixon Art Building, which now is gone. They demolished it. But
how many feet was that building?
It was 8 stories, and I think it was probably in the realm of like maybe 500 or 700 feet. I don't know. What's 8 stories?
Well, I think it's more than 800
maybe
feet.
Maybe more than what?
I think it's more than 800 feet.
Like 800 feet? Yeah.
No, I think it's more.
But oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, it was a very high, it was an insane thing to do.
Did you climb to the very top?
I climbed all the way up to the roof, and I actually got in back into the building through a door on the roof, which is funny enough where all of my friends were always hanging out. Mark, and I believe that when I did this climb as a performance for a video, I'll just say this, which is kind of interesting. That video right now is on display in Biel, Switzerland as part of an exhibition there. And it's been shown now just because it is a really cool video.
That is an awesome video. I've seen
it. You've seen it.
Yeah, because you're kind of wearing all white, too.
And you're wearing
a
motorcycle helmet. So you're wearing kind of like a white spandexy jumpsuit.
Mm-hmm. And a white spandex jumpsuit and a white motorcycle helmet.
Yeah, and the building itself was brick. So
it was brick. And I got the idea because I was doing lots of performances. Actually, that's the one that people know about. But I was constantly, and even to this day, I still do performances in that costume.
No way.
It was a character I invented called the Terrestrial Being. And it was kind of my alter ego for any time I thought of or saw anything that seemed out of the realm of possibility for me to do as Rachel, I could become the terrestrial being and do it. And so it often has led to me doing things in architecture. And at that time, I would do lots of different performances on various buildings and just interact with the architecture. And when I saw that they had put in some rebar on that building for seismic reconstruction after the earthquake, I just looked at it and I thought, you know, that looks like a scalable building. Like, it was completely easy to scale.
And had you been doing like rock climbing for some time before doing that?
So I trained for a few months just to be able to have the stamina to do it in my costume. And then I actually scaled that building every night for a month without anyone knowing in the middle of the night. I know. And then
amazing.
I only videotaped it when I actually was really, really, really sure that I would be able to do it seamlessly.
And wait a minute. When you were training, was there anything below to catch you if you fell?
No, and in fact, I didn't even use ropes. So
even when you were training?
Nope, I did it once with ropes, the very first time. And then I realized it was so easy, I didn't need ropes.
I mean, in the video, you make it look so effortless. It's almost like you're kind of floating against the building.
It was actually very effortless, except for one spot, which to this day frightens me when I watch the video. I did slip a little in one terrible moment, and it was because my motorcycle helmet made it hard for me, and I was, you know, fogging up, and I didn't quite see the rebar stick. So that's why I wanted to train, because I really wanted to know my route so that when I put that motorcycle helmet on, I would be totally cool. I know, that was totally nuts.
But amazing. I think it was such an amazing piece. And actually, when they said it, I was like, oh my God, that's Rachel Mason.
And so, what? So, as far as the video goes, is it just a video of the actual climbing? Or?
Yep, that's it. It's just a very simple video where the cameraman filmed me. Actually, it was funny. I was just talking to my friend who shot it. He's now a filmmaker in Albania, Thomas Lagreshi, and he told me that if you listen closely in the video, you can hear him whispering Hail Mary, Mother of God. And I didn't know that he was so scared. And he's not even religious. He just said that it overcame him with, like, emotion, and he realized it afterwards that he was saying Hail Mary, like whispering it the whole time.
And did you face any like trouble from that performance? Like, because I know there was an audience there, and maybe some of the audience included your faculty.
Well, there wasn't supposed to be an audience. I actually had mentioned it to one of my faculty members, and he immediately said, don't do it, and if you do it, you're gonna have to be like expelled.
Which faculty member?
You know what? Now I'm blanking. I think it might have been John Baldessari or Alan Rupersberg, or I honestly cannot. It might have been Alan. I really can't remember. But what happened was, whoever told it to me predicted it right, because after I scaled the building, one of the students saw me and freaked out as I was scaling it and called some authority, I don't even know who, but what was funny is I was getting close to graduation, and I got a letter in the mail announcing that I was expelled officially. And I was actually a very good student, and the art faculty really liked me. I mean, if you think about who they were, you know, Chris Burton, Charlie Ray, they all did a lot of crazy shit. And so they appreciated all of, I did a lot of pieces, actually. That was just one. They really supported my work. And they all wrote on my behalf, apparently. I only found this out later, because I was accepted back into the school when I met this person called the Dean of Deans, and it was a really funny conversation with her, because she gave me a really hard talking to about it and told me I had violated some really official codes, like code 1.3.5, which is improper use of school facilities, which I thought was really funny. And she said, you know, the only reason that you're going to get back, like, accepted back in is because the faculty told us that they really wanted you to graduate. And she said, if it was up to me, I would expel you.
So you didn't even have to petition for that, or like?
I think they petitioned to get me back in. That's what it was. But it's kind of interesting now, because I wish I had some copies of some of their notes. I would have loved to see what they wrote. And also, you know, there's just such a legendary group of people who are no longer even there at the school, that it would have been interesting to see that faculty list, you know, whatever they had to say about me. But I don't know what would have happened to those documents.
So now you live in New York, and you're back in LA, and you're performing at PAM?
I'm performing at PAM, which is this program that Brian Getnick runs out of, I think, a studio type of space. And it's also with several other artists on this night. And I'm doing a little preview of Hamilton Fish, my film. And it's going to be about 20 minutes of some of the songs from the film. And I hope to actually present the full film somehow in LA in the coming year.
Did you want to go ahead and play one of the songs from the film?
Sure. Should I plug in my computer somehow?
Oh, have we not done that
already? I don't think so. I was going to say one other interesting thing about UCLA was, after I met the Dean of Deans, or around that time, I did another piece that was a pretty notorious, funny piece where I interviewed all of the deans at UCLA. Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't.
It was kind of...
How many deans are there?
There were like 14. And I scheduled interviews with all of them by kind of acting as though I was like an official person who was conducting interviews. But really, I was just this art student. And I ended up with all these really amazing interviews one-on-one with each of them. And they told me what it was like to be dean. And in the end, I made a sculpture that kind of hybridized all of the things they said.
And then I invited them all to come to this sculpture and look at it. And that became this performance where I dressed up as a dean and I pretended to be, you know, one of them. But secretly, I was just kind of staging this funny meeting with all the deans, and they made a very formal affair out of it.
Oh, wow. Did what were some of their reactions?
Well, I remember I ended up asking all of them what it was like to be dean, and they gave me these metaphors, and like the dean of the School of Dentistry, Dean Nohi Park, I remember saying to me, you know, I think the mouth is a window to the body, and the mouth is something that if you look at it, will tell you everything you need to know about a person. And so I made a little mouth, and every single dean gave me a metaphor, like making lemonade out of lemons is what my job is. So I made a little lemon pitcher, and I made all of these sculptures. And then I made this other sculpture called the Organism of Linkages, because that was a hybrid of all of their metaphors. They all kept using terms like that's what they do, make linkages. And I thought that was just so funny. So I decided to create this weird blob that they all stuck their fingers into. And it was also this performance of them sticking their fingers into this blob and pulling out their own metaphors, which then I later allowed them to keep. And I'd be curious to find them. I guess I should seek them all out and find those metaphors, because I made little paperweights for them to keep.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Thanks. And so I'll play one song here from my film. You were asking about it. This one is called The Werewolf of Wisteria, which is the name that was actually used for Albert Fish in the newspapers. And here it goes.
Okay. You're listening to Divided Daughters on KTRN Radio.
Thank you. piece of lint or a guitar pick? Where will he be once he gets there? He will find her. Maybe just more wallpaper and carpet. Maybe a piece of lint or a guitar pick. Where will he be once he gets there? I see the eyes in his rooms. They stare right back and tell me no. They tell me that I need to go. I won't find him
So that song needs massive explanation because it was one of the very first songs I ever recorded and gave anybody. And
I loved it. I thought it was awesome, Rachel.
Well, thanks.
And you should be really proud.
Well, it actually came on accidentally. It wasn't one of the ones that I was gonna set up, but of course my computer malfunctioned. And that song, it was the reason I played it was because, you know, we have this history of knowing each other kind of from a long time ago, and I was an undergrad at UCLA and just recording songs on my tape cassette player.
You know, I noticed there's like such a cool group of musicians at UCLA. I mean, like, art school bands.
Yeah.
There's so many totally talented people. Mm-hmm. Like, Voy was a band that came out.
Rye Rocklin, Cedar was a good musician. Cedar Bylard,
oh,
and
really?
A good artist.
He
plays ukulele, and then Mark Galumko was with us, and Nathan, who started
Nathan
this
Ihara?
Band called Nathan. He started this band called The Blood Arm. What's Nathan's Fragoso?
Yeah,
Nathaniel Fragoso. He was on tour with like. What's that man?
Franz Ferdinand.
Yeah,
back
some
in
like,
the day when they were really hot.
Some big, he I think was our indie star to emerge, right? And
I remember there was a German girl and a Persian girl, and they had a band too.
Oh,
I forget what they were called, but they were awesome.
So I played that song, and it was incredibly rough, and like lots of little starts there, just. For old time's sake, and it was one of my first recordings.
What was the name of that band?
Well, that was just me solo, but the band that I had with Mark Lumko and Michael Bauer was called Holland Every Day, and we came up with that band name because we just flipped a dictionary opened and got two different words and put them together.
But wasn't that song under the label like Little Band of
Actually I have a band now with my partner Dimitri Volgan and another woman who I work with in New York, Mara Mayer, and that is called Little Band of Sailors, and we regularly perform lots of shows with lots of great bands, and we recorded an album, and this is another little amazing UCLA and art tie-in. So we have a album, and it's called Woman with a Suitcase, and the name comes from the album cover, which was given to me by John Baldessari, the conceptual artist, because he was my number one biggest supporter since graduating UCLA, and I mentioned to him that I was doing an album, and I forget exactly how it came up, But he said to me he had never really done an album cover before. And I was like, well, would you do our album cover? And sure enough, I didn't actually expect him to do it. But he followed up with this amazing picture. And it's a woman with a suitcase. And I was so excited about it that I actually named the album that and wrote a song about it as well. But we have...
Do you want to play one of the songs?
Sure. I will play this one called Snowman.
Okay.
Thought I saw diamonds on the ground, a snowman's eyes melted out. I picked them up and brought him back to life. His tears fell out, but icicles survived. Snowman with no eyes, heal my human eyes.
With Divided Daughters on K Chung Radio with special guest Rachel Mason.
Hey.
So we'd love for you to play another song. You just mentioned how you did some recordings about some political leaders, maybe using even like their own words. Tell us more about that.
So I have a project called the Ambassadors Project, which actually connects to a body of sculptures. And I sculpted political figures that were involved in wars during my lifetime. And because the other thing that I do is sculpture, I do performance and music and sculpture. And so these, as I was spending a many number of years on this body of work, I kept staring at these little sculptures of people like Saddam Hussein or, you know, various political figures, and just thinking about them. And as I also write songs, it invariably led to me writing songs about them. And some of their songs came from things that I actually, like when Saddam Hussein was executed, I read in the New York Times his final words that were written like a poem. And as I read them, it just...
His final words were a poem?
They were, his final written words were a poem that read to me like a rock song, just a song. I mean, as soon as I read them, I could hear it playing out. So because I was writing songs about political figures, I immediately transcribed this one. And I should say one other interesting story about that. There's other figures that, for instance, Manuel Noriega, I wrote him a letter and he wrote me back and we corresponded for a little bit, just a few letters back and forth. And I wrote a song that I would say was co-written with Manuel Noriega, the imprisoned Panamanian leader. There's another song that I wrote about a Chechen leader called Dzhokhar Dudayev, and I wrote it from the point of view of imagining myself being the Chechen leader fighting the Russians. And that song eventually became a kind of anthem that has appeared in many places on the internet. So that song is called My Chechen Wolves. And I'd be more than happy to play one of those songs if you'd like to hear.
Well, I would love to hear the one based on the last words
of
Saddam. Yeah, okay. By Saddam.
So the song
Wait, what is it called?
It is called Unbind It. Here it goes.
Unbind your soul. It is my soulmate, and you are my soul.
cheap in hard times, we never kneel or bend. Blood is cheap in hard times, we never kneel or bend. And we treat our enemies with honor. And our bath party blossoms are branches turning green. The medicine does not cure the ailing, but the wild rose does.
Okay. You're back with Divided Daughters on K-Chung Radio. Special guest, Rachel Mason. So tell us more about that song you just played.
Well, it's those. The entirety of that song is written by Saddam Hussein. I didn't write those lyrics. I just set them to music. I was just going to read you the chorus. Unbind your soul. It is my soulmate, and you are my soul's beloved. No house could have sheltered my heart as you have. If I were that house, you would be its due. You are the soothing breeze. My soul is made fresh by you. And our bath party blossoms like branches turning green. The medicine does not cure the ailing, but the white rose does. That's written by Saddam Hussein. And I just set it to music as part of the project called the Ambassadors Project, and it's volume 2. I have 2 albums of songs, and cool. That you can find them online. If you just look me up, my website comes up, I think, Rachel Mason and Art, because there's lots of Rachel Masons out there.
Very cool. Another reason why we asked you to be on the show was because you know, you have an interesting connection to Circus of Books, which is pretty much like a, you know, printed book magazine institution, I would say, in Los Angeles or a couple locations. Mm-hmm. How long has it been around? And tell us your connection with that.
Well, you could say it was an institution of sorts. It is more known for its over 18 section and erotic paraphernalia, and I would say that it might be one of the oldest gay porn stores in California, maybe even in the US. And my parents have had it since the late 70s, I think, early 80s, when they moved to LA. My mother moved here from Chicago, but my dad was already here. But they got the business because they were delivering magazines, Hustler magazines. And Larry Flint put out an ad saying he needed people to deliver Hustler magazines. And the bookstore at that time, Book Circus it was called, was on their delivery route. And as they were delivering magazines, the store just started to go out of business. As it turned out, the owners were getting into a lot of problems, and my parents got the business. And lo and behold, they have successfully managed a gay porn store for many years. And I invited a friend of mine, John Knuth, to host some art exhibitions in there, and it led to him running a gallery called Circus Gallery in their warehouse on Lexington for a few years. So there's been a little bit of an art history connection as well to the store.
And I heard from Julie, who's no longer here right now. She's over at the Confetti Confidential event, collaging. But I heard from her that you were planning to make a documentary about the bookstore.
Well, it's been something that I've thought a lot about, and I go in there periodically with my camera and shoot footage just because my mother always threatens to close the store, which never seems to happen. But I am hoping to make a documentary, and I, you know, living in New York, I will say I'm very, very connected to the gay world. In fact, I you know, gay adult materials world. I have a good friend, Billy Miller, who publishes a magazine called Straight to Hell, which they've carried since the early days when a man named Boyd McDonald started it. And Billy is good friends with my family, and he's somebody that I also know in the art world. And, you know, I've played many a show where in New York I've mentioned the Circus of Books because it has some relevance to some place. Recently I was performing at the Bureau of General Services Queer Division. It's a store, a gay bookstore of sorts in New York. And I mentioned that it reminded me of home because it reminded me of the Circus of Books, and the whole audience clapped, and I realized, oh, wow, okay. You know, it's got a reputation even in New York. And a guy came up to me afterwards and said that he had been going to the store since he was in high school in the 60s. So that meant that, you know, that store's been around even since before my parents ran it. So it could actually be the oldest gay porn store in the country, or definitely on the West Coast.
And what was the specific interest that your parents had in carrying like gay porn, or just maybe porn in general, or?
Well, this is what is so fascinating about their story, is they have absolutely zero interest in it. I mean, aside from it being a product that sells very well, or used to sell very well, you know, that they, my mother likes to say that they were stewards of a existing store, and, you know, people were buying stuff and they were going to keep stocking it. And they, you know, they had like the same employees for like 30 years. I grew up with employees that I just knew, who I found out later were just, you know, very capable at this job. And my mother just wanted to keep them. So they, you know, that because my mother knows nothing about the business. Although as I started shooting the documentary, I started to realize that in a funny way, my parents actually do know a lot about the business, and they have learned a lot. And, you know, my mom can probably tell you, you know, half of what's in their inventory just because she knows about what they carry and what sells. And so in a funny way,
right,
they have an
expertise. She has to be like a curator of sorts, right?
Well, she doesn't actually curate, but she just knows, like, she does the back end of things that sell. So if something sells, you know, it's very much a business. And I would say that by virtue of running a business very successfully, they have learned about it. You know, a lot of the things they sell are related products, you know, not even just videos, but magazines or... Well, stop by the store and see. It's on Santa Monica Boulevard for people in LA.
Well, there are several locations, right?
There's one in Silver Lake. That one also has an over 18 section and a regular section. And then that is on, I think, Sunset, where it meets Virgil or Vernon. Is that the street? It's near Silver Lake.
I think it's Virgil.
Virgil. And then the other one is on Santa Monica at La Jolla.
Very cool. And yes, well, we're really interested and excited about the documentary you're thinking about making.
Cool, me too. Hopefully I can get it together and I'll keep you posted.
Very cool.
Okay.
Did you also want to play another song as we...
Sure, I'll end on one more song that was... I have a longtime collaborator who mixes songs for me named Jeff Hasse, who's here in LA. He's the partner of a curator named Sarah Larraguerra and a writer who's wonderful. And I'll play this last song that Jeff Hasse mixed. It's his engineering work. It's called Marry Me Mary, and it's also...
Thanks so much, Rachel, for being on the show.
Thank
Very
you.
Excited about all your projects. Come back soon.
I will. Hopefully to scream Hamilton Fish very soon.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Make no sounds in the garden when they pass over mountains of gold. Tiny kingdoms in stone, stone will survive unless it loses the will to stay alive. And you pretend to sleep so heavy like a saint's sarcophagi. Your marble tomb is getting old and clinging to a strip of earth that bears your name and holds your place, but will not sacrifice a tear to mark a face it cannot cry. Marry me, marry me, marry me, marry, marry me, marry me, marry me, marry me. Marching to a ringing of sirens, we pass under arches.
Will return with broken eyes and golden teeth, and he will be.